Hello, everyone, and welcome to our Chapel for International Education Week. Our theme for this week is Stand By Me. As we speak, thousands of people all over the world are being affected by war and weapons of war, such as military drones. We ask you to stand by that suffering and to open your minds to the possibility of peace coming out of negative intentions. To elaborate on this topic, we have Jay Parrish with us today. Mr. Parrish received a bachelor's degree in geology from Millersville University and a master's and a PhD in geophysics from Penn State. He has extensive work experience in remote sensing, served as a state geologist of Pennsylvania, and is currently working at Penn State. As far as he knows, he's the only geophysicist in Mennonite Church USA and a member of the East Chestnut Street Mennonite Church in Lancaster. Please help me welcome Jay Parrish.
Thank you very much for that introduction. I'm going to set my timer because I've been told that it's imperative that I not go over. That's all right. You'll like it so much you won't care. So, drones. Everybody wants to hear about drones in war. The first thing is they aren't really drones. They're unmanned aerial systems. But if I kept saying unmanned aerial systems, you would lose interest quickly. So I'm just going to say drones, and we'll move on. The Global Hawk is probably the one that's started all this. It's a very large drone that flies at high altitude. It's mainly for surveillance, or only for surveillance. It's a great research tool. NASA has one. They fly it up to the North Pole, and it stays up there for a couple days and comes back again. It does things that are incredibly boring and dangerous without endangering lives or having people just be bored to death. The Predator, you're probably more familiar with, it started out as a surveillance system, meaning it just collected information. And it was deliberately made to be cheaper than the Global Hawk, because the Global Hawk was $50 million, and the military said that if it was $5 million, it's expendable. So they're $5 million machines. And everybody wants one. Later on, they decided they could put weapons on them, and that's why we're in the position we are today, because it started out as something that could just look, and then they decided it could become a weapon. Even small handmade system, handheld systems, as small as a small bird or little airplanes like this that could cost up to $50,000 are considered expendable. And everyone knows that drones are evil. This is one taking off from north of Las Vegas. You can see the long wingspan. That's actually on Google Maps. And there we go. The military uses them for killing people, and it creates enemies for us on the ground and damages the mental health of those who use them at home. But you knew all that. So if that's what I was going to talk about, that would be the end of the talk. But we're not. Because drones aren't evil, they're just drawn that way. And in many ways, they're like rat poison. Rat poison is of interest to us because people don't like rats. They destroy crops, they carry disease, they're everywhere. Even feeding them poison can be useless. When I was working at the Lancaster County GIS, we mapped dead rats based upon how much poison was put out, and they ate more poison than we could afford. They just kept coming back, so it was a useless exercise. We just mapped lots of dead rats. But my doctor wants me to take rat poison. I was born with a defective heart valve, and I could get it repaired, which doesn't last that long, or I could get it replaced with a cowl valve, which lasts longer, or use a mechanical valve, which makes a lot of noise, and you have to use blood thinner to keep the blood from clotting. And the way to do that is to take a little bit of rat poison, because rat poison is something that rats eat, and it makes them bleed to death internally. So, hello, there we go. So I take rat poison in a small dose, and it's a medicine. I take it in a larger dose, and it's poisonous. So in a small dose, we call it Coumadin. Otherwise, we call it rat poison. So is rat poison bad? Well, it depends how you use it. Likewise, drones can be used for good. They can deliver pizzas. Here's Domino's delivering pizza. You can just call up and say, I want my pizza. There's one that's called the Burrito Bomber. You tell them, you use your phone and say, here's my XY coordinates, and it brings a burrito over and drops it on you. You can monitor crops. You can look at unexploded ordnance. You can map dangerous situations or places where you can't put a person in easily, like after this recent typhoon or a flood or an earthquake. It's easy to put someone in. You don't risk a life, and you're not interfering with people. So it's a very nice solution to many problems with peaceful uses. You can use it to deliver medicine. You know, instead of going to the, when you have a child who's sick, you don't have to run to the pharmacy late at night. They can just have it delivered to your door. And what a relief that would be instead of having to leave a sick child at home. But, oops, I guess you also saw, you can use it to deliver illicit drugs. So we're going to go on to a book that I use in my classes. I teach online classes, or taught online classes at Penn State in remote sensing and drones. And Sleights of Mind is about the neuroscience of magic. And we're going to apply that to art and then apply that to drones. Macular degeneration. When you look at things with your eye, you have a lot of pixels in the center of your eye, and then you have peripheral vision. Your peripheral vision has low resolution pixels. But we fill in so it looks like everything looks the same to us. So we actually have a very changeable resolution pattern as we look across a room. Rembrandt knew this, and this is a self-portrait of him. And he has lots of great detail in the eyes. You look at it, and it's just amazing what he does. He brings out all the life in himself. But those are his hands, and essentially he made 3 brush strokes. So we look at his face with our eyes in the center of our, with the pixels in the center of our eye, and what we see is the eyes and the face, and then we fill in with our peripheral vision what's around it. So our brain says, yeah, it must be a really great painting. Look at all the detail in the face, and the hands have to be just as good, because my eye is telling me it's just as good, because I filled all that in. What a masterpiece. In reality, only the face is a masterpiece, and the bottom part anybody could have done. So if you look at another self-portrait of him, it's hard not to look at his face. All the attention's focused on his face. And yet he's holding a palette there. And that's what it looks like. I can't even see a hand in that. So this is, I'm sure everyone will appreciate me saying that. So you can put away your smartphones, because you really can't concentrate on several things at once. Your eye is focusing on one thing and filling in details around the edges. And that's why a magician can do magic tricks. And they make you look at one hand while you're doing something with the other hand. And it's called misdirection. And that's what Rembrandt was kind of doing. He was saying, hey, look at this face. It's really good. And this is probably really good down here, too, so don't pay any attention to it. And your peripheral vision says, yeah, it must be really good, because, you know, it all fits together. So anybody want to identify what that is? The Mona Lisa. Very good. So this is the Mona Lisa. I went there and saw it for myself, and I was in awe. And I went up to my wife and put my arm around her and said, this is really the Mona Lisa, can you believe it? And I turned and it wasn't my wife. But see, I had been focusing on the Mona Lisa, and my peripheral vision told me very carefully that this was my wife next to me. I was sure it was my wife, and therefore I felt free to put my arm around her. It was a little surprising for her. The same thing. I was filling in details where I didn't have enough information. I didn't have enough information, so my mind said, well, it's probably your wife over here. It looks a lot like her. Call it your wife. So Da Vinci made use of this. You know, there's a big controversy, is she smiling or not? And what he did was he painted a little bit of shadow in her cheek, and your peripheral vision picks that up when you look at her eyes, and it gives you the hint that she's smiling, but if you look at her mouth, she's not smiling so much. And so he's actually making use of that in the painting. On 9/11, I was in St. Louis, and I wrote down what I'd been doing that day, and I thought, I'm going to compare notes with somebody who was there with me, and we'll see just how much difference there is between our stories. And I asked Eric to write his version of it all, and he said he wasn't there. And it turns out he'd left the day before, and I was so convinced that he was there that I filled in all kinds of detail about his life for the day that he wasn't there. That I actually believed it. So with 9/11, I filled in missing detail about Eric's presence because I didn't have the information. My mind filled in the detail, which must have been there. I knew that he'd been there the day before. There was this big event. He must have gotten home somehow. How did he get home? I made up a story in my mind about how he got home. With insufficient information evidence, we fill in the details. Just like that version of Mona Lisa, there's not enough information here to tell you it's the Mona Lisa, but we figure it out by looking at the pattern. And we take hints to fill in missing information. So let's turn our eyes to Vermeer. This is a hyperspectral image of my eye, just for future reference. Hyperspectral means you have like 2,000 channels of information about it. So I can tell you the composition of every bit of my eye and the skin and all kinds of things. But we're going to look at a forger during World War II who forged Vermeers. And you're probably familiar with this painting or a modern version of it. And this is a guy named Van Meegeren who said, well, I can make a portrait like that, but I won't just paint the same thing. I'll make it look like it. And then people will think it's a Vermeer. So he did the same thing with an earring, a little bit different facial expression, and Andrew Mellon bought it for several million dollars. So people looked at things and said, this has all the elements of the real thing. It must be the real thing. They fill in that detail where the information is missing and say, oh yeah, it must be what I'm looking for. And he went so far as to sell some of these to Hermann Göring during World War II. This was a dangerous combination. It's like having a fireworks factory next to a propane tank farm. It worked great until the war was over, and then he was arrested for collaboration. And he said, I can prove that I painted all those things. Here's a real Vermeer. Here's my version of it. It has a lot of the same things as the last one. It has, Göring saw the pearl and the blue smock and the chairs and the note, and he said, hey, this must be a Vermeer. He saw what he expected, and he then accepted it to be true. So Van Meegeren admitted he faked the paintings and said, I'll paint one for you, and then you'll see that I'm really pretty good at this. So that was one he did. He did another one here. You notice the stark faces and the blue cloth and the scarf over her head. And Hermann Göring had purchased that for $4 million because he was very eager to own Vermeers because Hitler had Vermeers and he wanted more Vermeers. And this one has an angular face and the headscarf and the blue robe, but the problem is I painted it. But we come to expect whatever anybody tells you, then you accept it because you're looking for it. So what's the takeaway from all that? Your ability to detect information that contradicts your established beliefs is crucial for learning about the world. And that's something you need to think about. Think about the military's use of that and then what you take out of that. You have to be willing to look at your established beliefs and say, this contradicts what I normally think, instead of saying, well, I'll make it fit into my view. Say, how can I account for that? Not just use that peripheral vision trick. One of the problems with drones, or the good things, is that drones are particularly good at doing boring things, extremely boring things. They can do it for hours and hours and never get tired. But if you have a human being watching it, it gets pretty boring. And for my students who do this for a living, they say that they have a big bowl of candy and they go and eat candy in between shifts. So there's a lot of candy eating going on and people being very bored just watching and watching and watching. So what if you're tasked with doing that? I'm missing a picture here. Okay. The drones make use of panchromatic imagery, which means black and white, and it's video, and it means it's moving. Instead of hyperspectral, remember my eye, where I have all kinds of information, they have just shapes to go by, not a lot of chemical content to go by. And then, so what they do instead is they look at patterns of behavior. So they look for indicators. So you look for people who are associated with people who you think are doing bad things, and then you look for people who travel between those places where you think things are happening, and you look for them carrying objects that might be suspicious. And then anyone who fits that profile becomes an enemy. So it's easy to see what you expect. In this case, on the bottom one, there's a guy poking his head around the corner with something suspicious, and it turns out to be a telephoto lens on a camera. But you fill in that missing information. So do we do more harm than good by having this technology? Some people would say yes, it does a lot of harm because you have a lot of enemies being developed by this, but it's cheap and it's low risk. Remember, the $5 million drone is considered expendable. You don't have to have any soldiers on the ground. You have pretty much unlimited power to go anywhere without consequence. And how can any national leader or militant group or any other group resist the allure of that? I mean, it's kind of like takes away all the risk in doing what you want to do. The problem becomes, do we want to become a nation where you go to work, kill a few people remotely, and come home for dinner that night? And what does that do to your psyche? And right now, it's a monopoly technologically that we have, but we aren't going to have forever. And what happens when that starts happening on U.S. territory, or the U.S. starts doing it with their own citizens? It's an asymmetric type of warfare. Right now, we have the technological advantage, but it's not exactly rocket science. I once worked at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, and we had t-shirts that said, actually, it is rocket science. But in this case, it's not rocket science. Anybody can make a drone and fly it. Now, the Pentagon has always said we have to have a man in the loop, that person sitting there watching this boring video day after day after day. And that has an advantage to it, because you have that human factor of making an interpretation, but you also have the tiring factor of maybe poor decision-making as you get tireder and tireder. So perhaps other countries will say, let's put a robotic interface here, let's have an automated system. We may resist that because we say, well, that might lead down a dangerous path. But as other countries do that, are we going to be able to resist the temptation to create our own robotic armies? So would it be better to have a robotic army and an automatic interpretation? Can you actually write code that makes a moral decision about whether it's right or wrong to shoot at somebody? And who determines what that morality is? Is it the government that does that, or the military who writes the rules, or is the church going to write rules? Is there any sense for forgiveness there, where someone can look at it and say, this is an extraordinary circumstance, we're not going to do this if it's all automated? So robot soldiers might be able to resist the passion of warfare, the tiredness, the lack of sleep, the vengeance, the anger. But on the other hand, they're utterly devoid of human compassion. So this is a book you might want to consider, How to Survive a Robot Uprising. One of the pages in there that I photographed here says, have no mercy, your enemy doesn't, because robots don't have that characteristic. Isimov, a science fiction writer, said, well, there's a way around that. You have three rules for a robot. A robot has to live by these three rules. It can't injure a human being. It has to obey all my orders unless it means injuring a human being. And it has to protect its own existence unless one of the other two negates that. So this seemed like a very nice system for having very safe robots. Unfortunately, nobody's implemented any of that in the current world. So if they have no morals and are immune to anger, they can also be immune to pleas for mercy. They can hunt without end even after the war is over, something like you find with landmines. The intended use is done, but they continue to kill. Same with a drone that's programmed to do something. You can say, well, the war's over, I'm going home, but my drone's still up there circling around shooting. And who are they going to hunt? They're going to hunt people who fit a profile, no matter how bad that profile might be. So swarms of autonomous, self-replicating drones charging up on electric lines and carrying out their missions indefinitely could be in our future. By that, I mean, you know how you can have an electric toothbrush that you just put on a little pedestal and it charges overnight? Drones can do the same thing. They hang out near a power line and they can recharge. So they can live indefinitely, just recharging all the time. So you could go into a city and there'll be, instead of birds on the wires, there'll just be drones hanging around on the wires all the time, recharging. And they're autonomous and it can be self-replicating. I actually saw some in Switzerland that you put all the parts out and they can make another one of themselves. And then that one can make another one of itself, as long as it has material. And then you make another drone that specializes in collecting material and bringing it. And then you have a whole system where it's just a self-replicating system. And they can also be used to hunt tirelessly for victims in a disaster. So it can be used for great harm or for great good. So what do we talk about? Things in themselves are not evil, but can be used for good or evil. Drones can be used to kill or help. The allure of drones lies in their low cost and low risk. We fill in missing information, and we see what we expect to see. And we've bypassed the whole idea of having rules for robots. We've just gone ahead without that. And that leaves open the possibility of unlimited autonomous robotic killing machines. So what are you going to do about it? If we humans created this, are you going to wait and see if somebody else comes up with rules? Are you going to come up with rules? And if you do, how would they be implemented and enforced? And how could you change the direction of how robotic aerial systems are used? What alternatives can you offer? So what does God expect of us if we make a new technology? This is ultimately the question. We've created something. It can be used in different ways. What are we supposed to do about that? And I think that brings me to the end of my talk. I'm supposed to say that there's a workshop. We can talk more about peaceful uses, politics, or science fiction if you want to go into the future, or anything else that interests you. This is me with my email, Cotrank. And when I told my son I was going to be the state geologist of Pennsylvania, he said, "Great, Dad, now you're king of the rocks and nobody cares." So that's what Cotrank stands for. So now you'll always be able to find me. All right. Thank you.